Tomorrow, of course, is June 6th, the 70th anniversary of D-Day. That's the day the Allied forces invaded France to reclaim it from Nazi Germany and begin the push that forced Hitler's forces to retreat and finally surrender. World War II was brutal and long and incredibly costly. But it also gave us inspiring stories of courage from military people and civilians alike. Today's guest tells one such story in his book, A Higher Call, now out in paperback. It concerns a crippled American bomber trying to return to England, a German fighter plane with the bomber in its sights, and an ending you would not have expected. Adam Makos is the primary author with Larry Alexander. Adam is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, and I understand today marks 23 weeks on the bestseller list for A Higher Call.
Yes, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me on the show. It is. It's 23 weeks, which is a pretty incredible thing, but the story is just that good. It's not my writing. The story is that good.
It is that good. And I'll tell you, let's start with you, though. You're a historian, journalist, and author, and obviously a longtime interest in all matters military. Where did that come from?
My interest in this subject matter came from my grandfathers. Both were in World War II, and growing up, they took me to air shows, museums, and they got me interested in that black and white era of theirs. At least I thought it was just some black and white era. And then as you discover these stories, it comes to life. And so as a very young person, I loved talking to these old veterans. And I started to record their stories and came to work for an aviation magazine. And that's where I found the story of Charlie Brown and Franz Stiegler, which is considered to be the holy grail of World War II stories.
It really is a good one. I mean, here again, crippled bomber and pursuing German fighter. And, of course, the fighter's going to shoot the B-17 out of the sky, but he didn't. And,
yeah.
And obviously, there's a lot of detail that gets up to there, but want to make sure that we're, you know, anybody could have Googled the ending by now. I want to talk about a little more about you, though, because it looks like, from the way you write about it in the book, that your career choice was essentially, we got bored one day and became journalists.
That's exactly how it happened. My brother, my best friend, and I, we had our computer, and it was raining, and we decided we were going to start a little home-based publication. And we said, all right, what are we going to do? What are we going to write about? What's our topic? And so many young people, we were probably 16 years old at the time, so many young people like sports heroes, or they like cars, and we said, let's write about World War II veterans. So we were kind of odd to begin with, at least in the eyes of our generation. But we were lucky because we started at that early age where World War II veterans were still in their 80s, and they were still in our midst. And that's how we came to stumble upon the story of Franz and Charlie. I was interviewing B-17 pilots and gunners, and they kept saying, have you heard the story of the German who spared the American bomber? And I said, oh, that's just a tall tale, because when you hear something that's too good to be true, it usually is. And in the case of this story, I just had to look into it. I just had to call the American pilot at the center of the story. And that's how I discovered it.
And yet you begin the book by saying that the story told in A Higher Call is a story you never wanted to tell.
That's exactly right. I had a bias against the Germans who fought in World War II. I think it was more or less just a naive sort of simplistic view. I said, well, these old World War II veterans I've been interviewing have become my best friends. And these Germans were trying to kill them during the war. They killed many of their comrades. So I hear these tragic stories of young Americans sacrificing their lives. And I say, these Germans did it. And they were all Nazis, and they were all robots, and they all supported Hitler, and they cast us into this war. And I didn't really consider the idea that you could be a young man born in Germany, and when this Hitler guy came to power, you were 12 years old, you were 14 years old, and you were born into Hitler's Germany, essentially. You had no say, and when Germany went to war, everyone went to war. You were drafted, you were pushed at gunpoint, if it came to that, to the front lines. I never considered that there could actually be a good German.
Actually, it was some of the American veterans who began to soften your feelings about the Germans, wasn't it?
It was. I would hear these stories, and usually it was from bomber crewmen who were shot down over Germany, and they would tell these stories about how they were rescued on the ground by a German Luftwaffe sergeant or a pilot. Sometimes the German pilots, when they would shoot down an American bomber, they would land and later rush to the site of the crash, rush to the small village where the American parachutes came down, because they knew that the German people would many times, a farmer, a displaced worker from a city, would be inclined to lynch an American, because they had lost their home, they had lost their city, they might have lost a family member, their cows might have been strafed in a field by a fighter plane. And so these German fighter pilots and Luftwaffe members would often save Americans from German civilians. They'd take them back to the airfield, give them a good dinner, and send them off to a POW camp. But there was this strange respect between foes who fought in the air because they realized they shared the same hardships.
And again, the two key players, Charlie Brown, the American pilot, and Franz Stigler, the German pilot, they were both still alive when you started this process. And you went to Charlie Brown first?
I did. I actually I wrote to Charlie and I called him, and he was probably about 85 years old at the time. This is back in 2003. And I said, Charlie, I want to tell your story. I want to interview you about what this crazy German did that day. And he said, Adam, let me stop you right there. He said, do you really want to tell this story right? And I said, yes. And he said, well, then you have to start with a German first. In this story, I'm a character. The German Franz Stigler is the hero.
And in fact, we meet Franz Stigler before we get to know Charlie Brown in the book A Higher Call, now out in paperback, Adam Makos and Larry Alexander. Adam Makos is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more about what happened that day in December of 1943, as told in A Higher Call, back on the Jefferson Exchange with Adam and your phone calls and emails in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Adam Makos. He is the primary author of the book A Higher Call, on the bestseller list for quite a few weeks now. It is a story of valor in World War II, but an unusual sort of story. It's about a crippled American bomber trying to make it back to base in England after a bombing run in Germany. The German fighter pilot who came up upon the crippled plane and should have shot it out of the sky, as his orders would normally have demanded, but didn't do so. A Higher Call is the connection between that American pilot, Charlie Brown, and Franz Stigler, the German pilot, and what they learned about each other in the years after that day in December 1943. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange if you'd like to take part. 800-838-3760, 541-552-6782, email address jx@jeffnet.org. So you begin the narrative actually at the end of the war. What was Franz Stigler doing after his release from the military?
After his release, he was working as a manual laborer. And in Germany, it was tough to find any kind of job. Most of the cities, most of the industry was reduced to rubble. And so we start in 1946, and we show Franz he's looking for work as a brick laborer. And that was the amazing thing, that one day, a year earlier, he was flying a Messerschmitt fighter jet over Germany, defending against the bombers. And then a year later, he's in threadbare clothes, looking for work, living on food stamps and handouts from the Allies. And the other, I guess you could say, the real disgrace that Franz suffered was that as a fighter pilot, he was a pariah in their society, not during the war, but after, because the German people would look at their ruined cities, they'd look at their destroyed houses and the family they had lost in the war that had cost them everything, and they said, you know whose fault this is? Yes, it's Hitler's fault, but it's also the fighter pilot's fault because they failed to stop the bombs from falling. They must have been cowards. They must have been in dereliction of their duty. And so men like Franz had to hide from their acts of bravery, their acts of sacrifice. They had to forget the friends they had lost, and they had to try to blend into society.
And so really from hero to zero, but this is a guy who had come a long way just to be able to do what he did in World War II. Flying was really in his blood. I mean, tell us about the flying and the flying experiences in the Stigler family.
Yes, his father was an aviator in World War I. Franz's local priest, he was from Regensburg in Bavaria, so southern Germany. His priest had been a pilot in World War I. And in the post-war years, these men, they still love to fly. They love to fly gliders. And Franz and his brother, these young boys, started a glider club. and their father and the priest helped them build the glider. And these are just kids flying gliders, which is quite incredible today. It would never pass. But Franz and his brother August loved to fly, and Franz eventually became a pilot for the airlines. And when World War II broke out, that's when this other incredible twist happened. Franz was drafted, essentially conscripted, and he was made a flight instructor. And one day, one of his students was, of all people, his own brother. So Franz trained August to fly. He trained him as hard as he could, as best as he could, and he sent August off to war. Well, August was killed within a matter of months during the Battle of Britain. And that's how Franz embarked upon this quest for revenge. He asked to become a fighter pilot to avenge his brother. That's how he got in the cockpit that will one day put him behind Charlie Brown.
Wow. The revenge factor, a big one there. But, you know, I want to come back a few steps, though, because Franz didn't actually think he was going to be a pilot as an adult, did he?
Well, at first he thought he was going to be a priest. That was what his mother wanted from him. That's what everyone expected of him. And one day his priest sat him down and said, Franz, what do you really want to do with your life? And Franz said, I don't know. I'm going to become a priest. And he said, no, your mother wants you to do that. What do you want to do? And Franz said, I'd love to fly. And the priest said, go do it. Your mother will get over it. And that was one of Franz's early lessons in this idea that, because my research into the story was not about just what happened that day, but why. And the answer is Franz was slowly taught throughout his life to answer to his conscience, to answer to a higher power, to answer to a higher call, and not to just go along with what everyone else was doing. And that's actually a very good metaphor for Nazi Germany, because about half the country was in favor of Hitler, half the country wasn't. And still, the people that went along with that guy cast the world into this Holocaust. And so this was a lesson for Franz. Listen to your soul, not your orders.
And Adam, you mentioned your own feelings through the years about Germany and just the sort of lumping everybody into the Nazi bin, anybody who had anything to do with Germany during World War II. And then you mentioned that, you know, there are people who could have grown up during the Third Reich who really didn't know anything else, which was really the case with Franz Stiegler. He reached adulthood during the Third Reich. How political was he?
He wasn't political at all, Jeffrey. And that was the thing that was fascinating for me. And the book was a discovery. I didn't know that in 1933, when Hitler essentially ran for office, he won with 44% of the vote. The National Socialists won with 44%, the Nazis. And that means that 56% of Germany voted for someone other than the Nazis. The problem was the votes were split. So the Communists had their vote, the Social Democrats had their vote, the Catholic Party had theirs. The Farmers' Party even had theirs. And so they fragmented the vote. The Nazis got the lion's share. And so Hitler came to power with 44%. Franz's family was Catholic, and they didn't vote for Hitler. And so Franz grew up. Franz was just probably 15 years old when this Hitler guy emerges. And, you know, they had no say, because with 44%, he took over the country through maneuvering and backhanded deals. And before you know it, most of the young men who fought in World War II on the German side, in France, in Russia, in Italy, wherever, they were 12 years old when Hitler came to power. They honestly had nothing to do with that guy.
So in the situation particular to Franz Stiegler, I mean, here he is getting drafted into the Luftwaffe from his job as a pilot for Lufthansa. This is a tough spot for him. I mean, he's German, but he's Catholic. Obviously, the church and Hitler had no use for each other. Was there any period when he considered getting out of Germany? Did the Stieglers ever consider going someplace else?
That's a fine question. My understanding is that once Franz had lost his brother, at first it was rather innocuous. I mean, he became a flight instructor, so he wasn't killing anyone. His brother was on the sidelines. Yes, he was training young men to go off and fight Poland, but Hitler told the country, oh, the Poles attacked us, it's a border war. At first, there wasn't the kind of alarm, because World War II wasn't World War II yet. And so once Franz lost his brother, once Hitler attacked the Soviet Union and was in a two-front war against the whole world, I think by then it was too late for the Stiegler family to do anything. I think by then and most of Germany was under Hitler's grasp within a couple years of his rise to power. By 1934, he had built his first prison, which was a concentration camp, And he started throwing his political opponents in that. So anyone who had ran against him back in 33, those communists, the social democrats, the Catholics, they started winding up in camps like Dachau. So by 33, 34, 35, he's got the media under his control. He's got the postal system. He's got the military. He's got the railways. He's got every facet of German life under his thumb. So unless you saw this Hitler guy coming and you could get out at the start, after that, you were stuck with him.
Adam Makos is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the principal author with Larry Alexander of the book A Higher Call, now out in paperback, about the crippled American bomber trying to return to England from a bombing run in Germany, the German pilot who had every opportunity to shoot that bomber out of the sky and didn't, Franz Stigler is who we're talking about there. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So did Franz Stigler have to request moving from pilot training to actually being a fighter pilot himself?
Yes, he did. He he's guilty of this. He said, I want fighters. I don't want to be in reconnaissance planes. I don't want to be in bombers. I don't want to be in transports. I want to avenge my brother. And because he had so much flying experience, because he flew for Lufthansa for many years before this, they said, all right, fine, you can be a fighter pilot. And so he was shipped right away to Africa. And so he's this young man hungry for revenge now. And there he experiences this culture shock, really, because in the desert, this is 1942, America isn't over in Europe at that point. It's just the British and the Germans, and they fought by these unusual rules, at least in the air they did. They fought by the rules of World War One, and that was where enemies, because again, these guys, the Germans and British, had been fighting each other just two decades before. They suddenly treated their enemy with respect. If you were shot down behind the German lines, you could expect to be tended to by a German doctor. You could, you'd be given a dinner before they'd sent you off to the POW camp. Maybe the guy who shot you down would come pick you up in a Jeep and bring you back to the lines. The British did the same for the Germans. And so there was this odd respect between enemies there. And when Franz got there, he quickly learned that this is not a place for revenge. This is a place for men who are made to fight each other, made to kill each other, but who didn't necessarily enjoy it. And that's where Franz really began to change as a person.
It's a real sense of chivalry up there in the sky then.
It was. It was chivalry left over from World War One, and it faded as World War Two went on. So Franz Stigler, and I should say Charlie Brown, is very lucky that Franz reported to the desert first, where his perspective was changed.
You recount a conversation in the book between Franz Stigler and his dad about the fate of Germany. And this is actually fairly long before the war came to an end. But what conclusion did they reach?
They reached the conclusion that the war was over as of, they knew in early 1943 that the war was over. The day that Hitler launched a two-front war, they knew Germany was lost because they had seen how World War One was lost. His father was a World War One veteran. And he said, Franz, you're going to lose this war. And Franz said, I know, what do I do? And he said, all you can do now is fight for your country and fight to stop the bombs from falling. And that's all the German fighter pilots told themselves. They didn't say, we're going to go up and kill some Americans today. They didn't say, we're going to go kill some British. They said, you know, we're going to knock down a plane before it drops bombs on our city. So they were able to justify, at least the fighter pilots were, their duty in the war. They were able to kind of, in their minds, keep a clean conscience because they weren't going out there to stab somebody with a bayonet. They weren't sinking a merchant ship at sea. They weren't even bombing a Polish or Russian city. They were knocking down bombers before bombers could kill their countrymen.
And, of course, the key event in the story is Franz Stigler coming up against an American bomber, which is already crippled. We'll get into what happened there. And the pilot of that plane is Charlie Brown. Great name for a pilot.
It is. I thought it was facetious at first because Charlie Brown and the Red Baron, you know.
Snoopy and all that. So where did Charlie Brown grow up and what got him into the Army in the first place?
Charlie Brown grew up in Weston, West Virginia. He was from a coal mining town. He was a farm boy, actually, in a coal mining town. And you know, the amazing thing about his story is it's a rags-to-riches, true American story because he goes from being a 20-year-old kid herding cows to a 21-year-old bomber pilot. and he's given a B-17 bomber after he enlists in the Army, a crew of 9 men who are counting on him, and Charlie realizes how young he is. He realizes how unusual this is, and so he tells his crew, I'm 24 years old, because he didn't want them losing sleep over the fact that they had a kid flying them, and that's exactly what he was.
But yet he came into the Army through the infantry. So how did he end up going into the Air Corps? What was the set of circumstances that changed his trajectory?
Well, it's a funny story. He was in the National Guard, and then he was in the infantry, as you said. And at one point, he was in a boxing match during his training. Charlie was a soft kid, and he didn't like to fight. He didn't like confrontation. He was a quiet kid. And he said, I'm going to make myself box to make myself a little tougher. And sure enough, he got beaten up by this old-time Army sergeant. And the guy said, you're too nice a kid for this infantry thing. Join the Air Corps. It's more suited to your personality. And so Charlie did. He listened to the man. He transferred to the Air Corps. He didn't realize that he was transferring into what would be a unit that the 8th Air Force, that is, in England, the 8th Air Force lost more men than the United States Marine Corps in World War II. Essentially, Charlie thought he was putting himself into a softer, safer line of duty. But really, the casualty rates, he checked himself into a unit where you stood a 35% chance of surviving your tour, unwounded, without getting captured, without getting shot down. They were losing 5% of the bombers per mission. That doesn't sound like a lot, but when you go out, the next day, they've lost 5. The next day, it's another 5. The next day, it's another 5. Statistically, by your 20th mission, you should have been shot down or killed.
We're talking to Adam Makos on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is A Higher Call, about the chance meeting of an American and a German pilot in the skies over Germany in 1943, and they both lived to tell the tale. It's a fascinating one at that. The period of time, though, from Charlie Brown leaving the infantry until flying B-17 seems like it's not terribly long. Was this exceptionally fast, even by World War II standards?
It was. I think everything in 1941, 42 just heated up to these incredible speeds because America saw the war coming. So yes, it was a fast transition. But for Charlie, you know, I should say that day when he met Franz Stiegler, his first mission, he was still wet behind the ears. He was still a novice. Those young boys who flew the bombers, they really were learning on the job. We as a country had no experience like this. The Germans and British had been fighting for a couple years by then, so we had to learn on the job, and Charlie's first day at work was just one heck of a mission.
Now, before Charlie left for work, though, he got to meet a WASP. Who were the WASPs, and who was this Marjorie?
Well, Jeff, it was funny. This story almost had this kind of Hollywood-type romance where Charlie's training in Texas and this girl pulls up in a fast, sleek two-engine bomber behind him, and she drops out. And at first, everyone thinks it's a male pilot, and then he sees it's a beautiful girl named Marjorie Ketchum. And she was a WASP, one of the women service Air Force service pilots. And the WASPs, their job was to ferry planes from the factory to the units so that men could then take the planes into war. So it freed up men to go do the fighting jobs because at that time women weren't permitted. And Charlie has this quick and innocent romance with this girl. And it was a beautiful metaphor because here he meets this girl, he's crazy about her, he goes off to war, and 30 missions later, as Charlie is flying his missions, he stops writing back to her. He can't bring himself to stay in love with her. He literally changes as a person as he watches his friends being killed, as he comes close to death with every single mission. And when this girl asks him, how's it going over there, and oh, I'd love to fly over and visit you, and I hope to be your co-pilot someday, as a joke, Charlie couldn't take a joke anymore. He became, like so many men, you know, hardened and in a way kind of broken and introverted, and he became a victim of World War II. He survived the air war over Germany, but like so many men, it traumatized him. And in the end, he lost what could have been the love of his life.
Wow, that's amazing. I'm fascinated by just a couple of small details here, like the fact that Marjorie had to buy her uniform for the WASPs.
Yes, and so we tell that story. This is an unusual story in A Higher Call because it's a story of a good German. It's a story of a young American farm boy turned bomber pilot. it's the story of a wasp, a young girl, you know, cutting her teeth in 1942. And yes, the wasps had to buy their own uniforms. If they died in the line of duty, they had to pay for their own funerals. There was no insurance. They were treated as talented pilots, but second-class citizens in that time in America.
We'll pick up the story of Charlie Brown and the people he knew, including Marjorie Ketchum and Franz Stiegler, the pilot who did not shoot Charlie Brown's crew out of the sky that day in 1943, as told in the book A Higher Call, back with author Adam Makos. And you take your phone calls and emails here on the Jefferson Exchange when we return in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Adam Makos. He is the principal author with Larry Alexander of the book A Higher Call, now out in paperback after 23 weeks on the bestseller list. It is about a chance meeting in World War II in late 1943 between a crippled American bomber piloted by Charlie Brown from West Virginia and a German fighter plane that came upon this crippled bomber piloted by Franz Stiegler, who had every reason and right to shoot that bomber out of the sky and did not. The book, again, is called A Higher Call. We're talking about what drove these two men to do what they did. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Constance in Grants Pass sent an email. She writes, "What a wonderful story. Thank you. It brings to mind an anecdote my dad told me about flying wounded soldiers. He was in the Army Air Corps in Korea. He said that because the wounded did not have parachutes, the crew of the planes left theirs on the ground as well. I had not been able to verify this and wonder if Adam has heard that too. I always loved that and have often used it as a metaphor for advocating social justice. I'm also reminded of the wonderful books Beautiful Souls by Isle Press, Stories of Bravery and Conscience in Several Wars, and Truce by Jim Murphy about the Christmas truce between English and German soldiers during World War I. So a couple of tidbits to comment on there. Had you heard that one about the crews leaving their parachutes on the ground as they picked up wounded soldiers?
I had not, Jeff, but it's... certainly a beautiful sentiment, and I think even if they had their parachutes with them, they wouldn't use them. That is the attitude of the American fighting man.
And the Christmas truce, so much has been done about the Christmas truce during World War I, which obviously has turned into at least one movie, if not several.
Yes. The Christmas truce is it's that one rare example where, as you know, they stopped fighting and they went out and exchanged scotch and bourbon, and they talked, and there were even soccer games that broke out in no man's land between the trenches, and sadly there's nothing like that in World War II. It's almost like chivalry is fading with every passing year, with every passing war, and that's why the story of Franz and Charlie is so unusual. It's so ready for Hollywood, and in fact, one of England's greatest screenwriters has optioned the book and is crafting the script. A man named Tom Stoppard, who wrote Shakespeare in Love. He wrote Empire of the Sun for Steven Spielberg, and he's worked on Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade and other really big movies.
Oh, he's written some excellent works of his own, including Arcadia, which was performed at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival about 15 years ago.
Ah, yes, yes. He's like a living Shakespeare, and he saw this story, and he said, you know, this is one of the rare, beautiful moments to come out of World War II, because, you know, two men meet in combat, and they choose not to kill each other. Franz wasn't out of bullets that day. This was choice, and that makes for powerful drama.
So let's talk about Charlie Brown's mission, then. I mean, aboard the B-17, and I suspect you've been aboard a B-17 or two. What's it like in there?
Oh, it's an incredible machine because the walls of it are so thin, the steel and the aluminum. The aluminum is thinner than a pencil. And these young men would climb in this thing, and they would take it up to 25,000 feet above the earth, where it was negative 60 degrees below zero, and you're just in this can. It was literally flying in a tin can. And this bomber could fly from London to Moscow, and many times the missions that Charlie flew would last 8 hours. So you're going up in this primitive machine, open to the wind, in the cold, and not only do you have flak guns shooting at you from below, you have fighters attacking you from above. And the German fighter pilots were very, very proficient, deadly proficient. And so men like Charlie Brown, to fly into the face of that, it required great courage. And men like Franz Stiegler, to attack a bomber formation where every plane has its guns aimed at you. And so you're flying into 100 planes, and those planes each have 10 to 12 guns. Well, you're flying into 1,000 guns, and those guns are spitting bullets at 4 or 5 a second. You're flying into a wall of lead. And so men on both sides had to have great courage, and that's why I think the opposing airmen, the Germans and Americans, admired each other.
I understand that Charlie's plane in particular, which he called the Pub, already had some bullet holes in it from some previous missions.
It did. Charlie's plane was a used bomber. His crew was on their first mission that day when they went over to Bremen, and they were shot up over the target by just what we were talking about. They were hit by flak. They lost two engines. They were attacked by fighters, and they fell out of the sky, and suddenly they found themselves alone over Germany. And they were just limping home, trying to get back to England. Every ounce of that bomber was had a hole or a cut in it. It was a green-painted machine, and Franz Stiegler later said when he came up behind it, he saw silver patches everywhere because every bullet hole would strip away the paint. So this plane was a pockmarked, damaged, limping, sitting duck. And Franz came up behind it, and he said, "All right, when you shoot at me, I'm going to shoot at you." That was his rule. And he said, "Well, let God sort it out." And the bomber never fired back at him because it was so badly damaged, because the crew was wounded, because one man was dead. And that's why Franz didn't shoot that day. When he saw this plane, he thought it was defenseless. He thought it would be like shooting a man in a parachute.
Did he actually think it might have gone down by itself? Because, I mean, the plane was just a few hundred feet off the ground by this point, wasn't it?
Yeah, when Charlie and Franz met up that day, it was low above the northern German countryside, the bombers limping toward the ocean. And Franz thought it might well go down at sea. It might go down at any minute. And in fact, when he flew up alongside of it, the first thing he did, he flew up alongside the cockpit, and Charlie Brown looked over across his wing, and he thought, "I'm in a nightmare. This is a joke. This can't be happening." And Charlie closed his eyes, and he shook his head, and sure enough, the German was still there. And then Franz pointed down to the earth, and he was telling Charlie, "Land." And Charlie shook his head and pointed straight forward. So Franz stayed with him, and they kept flying together, and they went out over the ocean. And Franz pointed to the east, and he was trying to get Charlie to go to Sweden, because Sweden was a short flight away. It was neutral. Charlie could sit out the war. And Charlie Brown shook his head again, and he pointed toward England. And at the time, Franz was thinking, "You're crazy. This guy is a crazy man. He's never going to make it home. You've got to get your wounded men to safety." And Charlie at the time didn't know what this German wanted. He assumed that this German was going to take him back and shoot him down over his airfield, or he was going to shoot him down over the ocean. Charlie Brown didn't know what his enemy's motives were. And really, Franz just wanted to see these men survive the war. So in the end, Franz salutes. He says, "Good luck, you're in God's hands," and he flies away. And the encounter ended just like that. But for the rest of his life, Franz always wondered, did that plane make it home?
Charlie Brown's thoughts about Germans sound similar to the kinds of thoughts you had about Germans as a younger man.
Oh, yeah. Charlie expected the worst of this person. And in the circumstances, that was correct. But Franz Stiegler had learned a lesson in Africa, and this was so important. In the book we talk about this. Before his first mission, his squadron leader, a man named Rodel, said, "Franz, what are you going to do if you shoot down a plane today and you see a man floating in a parachute? Are you going to salute him, or are you going to strafe him? What are you going to do?" And Franz said, "Oh, I'll worry about that if it happens." Franz was just concerned with taking off and surviving the mission. And his commander, Rodel, said, "Wrong answer, young man." He said, "Let me tell you, if I ever hear that you've shot a man in a parachute or see you do it, I'll shoot you myself." And Franz just froze, and he said, and then Rodel said, "All right, now I tell you this for your good. You fight by the rules. You follow the rules, not for your enemy. You fight by the rules to keep your humanity, so that if you survive this war, someday you can look yourself in the mirror." And Franz is so lucky, and Charlie Brown is so lucky that those words were uttered, because when Franz came upon Charlie's damaged bomber that day, he saw it as a man in a parachute. He said, "This would be no different than shooting a man in a parachute, and I cannot have this on my conscience for the rest of my life." And that's why he took his finger off the trigger.
Wow. So some identification of humanity, even though on opposite sides in a very, very nasty war. Let's take a call here. We have Mark in Reading on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the book, A Higher Call, about an incident in World War II. Adam Makos is its author.
Yes. On the Christmas truce, the reason that such things didn't happen again is because when it did happen, the men didn't wish to go back to fighting. They were forced into starting to fight again. And so after that, every year at Christmas, there would be big pushes by both sides to prevent such a thing ever happening a second time.
Really? So they mounted big offensives rather than have anybody slow down for Christmas?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate that. I know your expertise field is World War II generally, Adam, but had you heard that about World War I before?
Yes, I had. And it's tragic and it's incredible. Yeah, after that, that was the only one. And it was pretty tragic because you do hear about the resentment these men had when they went back to fighting and how there was some talk that we should just end this thing. Among the soldiers, there was a lot of dissension after that first truce. And so there was some, if the men had their say, the war would have ended right there.
I want to come back to obviously what happened with Charlie Brown and the Pub, his B-17 bomber, and Franz Stigler catching him in the, was it a P-109? Was that the plane?
It was a Messerschmitt 109. Mm-hmm. So, yep, ME-109 is how it's mostly known these days.
So a couple of specific questions. First of all, was the bombing run successful? I mean, did Charlie's B-17 release the loads over Bremen? Did they hit the target?
They did. They were actually bombing an aircraft factory, and that was all part of the build-up for D-Day. America wanted to cripple the German fighter industry so that when our guys landed on the beaches, the German Air Force would essentially already be grounded, already be wiped out. And he did. Charlie Brown hit his target, and who knows, did he kill a factory worker? Was there some woman there with a couple kids back home? That was just the nature of the job. But when Franz Stigler spared Charlie, essentially Franz became a traitor to his own country. And at that time, a woman in a factory had told a joke, an anti-Hitler joke, and the Nazis had overheard it, and they had cut her head off just that summer. So when you think about what Franz did that day in letting a bomber escape, and then Charlie came back and bombed Germany 29 more times, he did something greater than treason, greater than being a traitor. So, you know, Charlie might have killed other Germans, but Franz said, you know, I have to take that chance. I have to take that chance and save my soul and save these men. And because he did that, Charlie's family and other families of his crew produced 100, 200 descendants. So many people came into life because of that chance that Franz took.
And one of the other specific questions then about the incident was Charlie's plane, was the Pub unable to fire upon Stigler's plane?
Yes, it was, because Franz came up from behind. The tail gunner was dead, and Franz saw the dead man slumped over his guns. Franz then pulled alongside the bomber, and he saw the waist gunners were both wounded. They were caring for each other, tying tourniquets. One had his leg blown off. He came up along the radio room, and the guns in that were knocked out. The radio operator had a sliver of a shell fragment in his face. And so every inch of this bomber, the nose was practically blown off, so the guns there were removed. The ball turret was frozen over, and so this bomber was like a ghost ship. It was completely defenseless, and Franz had flown enough that he had seen a lot, but he had never seen anything like this.
And yet, amazingly, Charlie Brown's B-17 makes it back to the airfield, an airfield anyway, in England. And I imagine, it, you know, at this point, he tells the story. It's like, oh, my God, this German could have shot us out of the sky, and I'm sure he did. But what was Stigler saying to his people back in Germany?
Oh, mum was the word back in Germany. Franz, if one person had seen the numbers on the side of his plane and called into his airfield, he would have been executed. He would have been shot by a firing squad. So Franz never mentioned a word of it. He was lucky. His base was actually several hours from where this battle took place. And so Franz had flown. He had attacked the bomber formation. He had landed and refueled. And that's when he spotted Charlie. So he was lucky after this happened. You know, a day later, he was back at his airfield. He was far from the scene of the crime. And for the next, 50 years of his life, he didn't tell anyone but his wife.
All right. So come back up into the present day, then both these men died about 6 years ago, and you had a chance to talk to Charlie, certainly. And he said, go research the Stigler story first. Did you get a chance to meet Franz Stigler?
I did. did. I went. I followed Charlie's orders, and I flew right out to Vancouver, and I interviewed the first German I had ever really met, and discovered the story. The incredible thing, and we won't spoil it, is that Charlie Brown wondered for the next 50 years after that encounter, who is the man who spared my life? Why am I living today? Who do I owe this to? Franz Stigler wondered for the rest of his life, what happened to that bomber? Did it make it home? And in 1990, Charlie, 1989, began searching for the German who saved his life. And in 1990, he found Franz Stigler, and the two of them reunited. And I won't say how he found him and how this came about, but these two men became best friends. And they began calling themselves brothers. And Franz would say, I lost one brother in World War II, and I gained another. And so until the end of their lives, Franz and Charlie spoke to school groups, to military units, to museums, to civic groups, and they told their story that not only could enemies lower their guns and become friends, enemies could become brothers. It had happened to them.
It is an amazing story, as told in the book A Higher Call. Adam Makos is the principal author, and he's been our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Adam, thanks so much for joining us. Great to talk to you.
Hey, thank you, Jeffrey. It's been great.
Bye. And that'll do it for today's Exchange. You can find more about the program and subjects and suggest a guest at jeffexchange.org. You'll also find show topics and recordings on our Facebook page with the same links available on Twitter. If you're listening in the morning, The Takeaway is coming up next. If you're listening to our evening rebroadcast, we'll be followed by news from the BBC. Tomorrow, Friday on The Exchange at 8 o'clock, it's the monthly return of our first Friday Arts segment. We'll run down lists of events in the performing and visual arts and ask you to join us as well. At 8:30, we'll talk about a Civil War reenactment coming to the region. At 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the creator. That's just too broad a term. He's also a filmmaker, writer, artist, William Joyce, specifically about his new book, The Number Leaves. That's all tomorrow on The Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. Our student assistant today, Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of The Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great day.